From KUAZ Radio in Tucson, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, safe water is vitally important to each and every one of us. Christopher Conover will bring us a look at the issue of perchlorate levels found in Arizona water supplies. We'll get a report on the invasive plant species buffelgrass and what's being done to prevent the threat that it poses during fire season from Robert Rappaport. I'll talk to an organizer of one of the many public events planned next month to celebrate Tucson's 232nd birthday. Pam White looks into the phenomena that is diminishing the number of healthy honeybee colonies in North America and what that means to the ecosystem. And Julie Bierock talks to the director of Arizona Project WET about a new book designed to teach the finer points of water conservation to kids living here in the desert. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. Environmental and health specialists are concerned about a substance called perchlorate, which is both naturally occurring and a man-made chemical. It's been found in contaminated water supplies throughout the Southwest. Next, Christopher Conover will talk to a USGS researcher about the perchlorate levels found in Arizona.
When it comes to industrial chemical waste, perchlorate is a particularly nasty one. It can, at higher levels, keep your thyroid from absorbing iodine. As an industrial waste, it's often associated with solid rocket fuel, but it also occurs naturally. And a new study from the U.S. Geological Survey shows that the naturally occurring perchlorate is particularly prevalent in the desert Southwest, according to Greta Orris, a USGS geologist based here in Tucson.
We've seen that in the desert here, it's been around for at least 20,000 years. We found it in old rat middens and stuff. So people have been surviving side by side with some level of perchlorate for as long as probably there have been people.
Perchlorate forms in the atmosphere and falls to Earth. So according to Orris, the weather is to blame for the higher levels of perchlorate in the desert Southwest.
When it rains in the desert, we've always noticed you go out in your backyard, you dig down, and you get down an inch or so, and it's dry. Well, it's that effect. What happens is the water doesn't infiltrate all the way to the groundwater so that it washes the perchlorate away. It sinks in a little way, and then it evaporates and leaves the perchlorate behind. Because while the rain washes the perchlorate out of the atmosphere, it does not take it when it's evaporated. It leaves it behind in the soils or the water or wherever it's raining. And so when you don't have big flushing events frequently, it just builds up.
The reality is probably more natural perchlorate exists than that left over from rocket fuel. But scientists are not so concerned with the naturally occurring compound.
The difference is the natural stuff is very dispersed, and what the contamination is from rocket fuels or fireworks or any of the other sources of perchlorate, they tend to be very concentrated and localized. They're very point source.
And even though the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency lists perchlorate on its contaminant list, Ora says cleaning up the naturally occurring perchlorate is just not worth the effort.
Well, it would sort of be fruitless because we have a constant stream from the atmosphere coming out in the rain, in dry precipitation from the atmosphere. So we're constantly adding this very low level but continuous amount of perchlorate to the soils and water and plants in this area.
According to an article earlier this year in the Journal of Exposure Science and Environmental Epidemiology, as of November 2005, just over 4% of community water systems in 26 different states contain perchlorate. And there are also questions about the amount of perchlorate in some food and milk. But a series of studies by the American Thyroid Association shows that perchlorate may not be quite so harmful as originally thought. It's theorized that the perchlorate gets into food from either crops being watered with perchlorate water or being fertilized with Chilean nitrate. The fertilizer in particular is suspect because the highest levels of perchlorate in the world are found in Chile, according to the U.S. Geologic Survey's ORIS.
And they're in a deposit type called natural nitrates. And they form in the same way. Essentially, nitrates and perchlorate form in the upper atmosphere where the ions react with ozone. So chlorines add a bunch of oxygens and they come out in the precipitation to make perchlorate, and it's much the same manner for nitrates.
The perchlorate study by the USGS is a 10-year body of work, and after all the sampling and testing, Ora says the biggest surprise for her was just how prevalent the compound is in nature. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
For more information about possible perchlorate contamination, we have a link to the USGS report online at kuaz.org. Bufflegrass is not a native plant species to Arizona. It originated in Africa, but it has now become well established in our state. The dry and reedy grass presents a danger because it is so readily flammable. Robert Rappaport will tell us next about major efforts at work to stop its spread.
It started harmless enough in the late 1930s as an African import for cattle grazing and a possible solution for soil erosion. But bufflegrass now is considered to be a dangerous invasive species covering all mountain ranges and urban areas in the Sonoran Desert. To get a first-hand look at the problem, two scientists and I recently took a short hike up Tumamoc Hill, west of downtown Tucson, a site that is covered in bufflegrass. Tumamoc is the home of the University of Arizona and U.S. Geological Survey's Desert Laboratory. Principal Research Specialist Travis Bean coordinates the Bufflegrass Eradication and Outreach Program on Tumamoc.
Bufflegrass fills in the interspaces between our perennial plants in the Sonoran Desert. So our Sonoran Desert is kind of characterized by these widely spaced plants. And so even if we were to go pour gasoline on a mesquite or a Palo Verde, throw a match in there, that mesquite or Palo Verde would burn to the ground, but it doesn't have anywhere to go because there's no fuel continuity. What bufflegrass does is adds a continuity to the fuel continuity of the landscape so our fires can spread over tens or thousands of acres.
Bufflegrass, which Bean says is spread by seeds in the air and moving vehicles, is a bushy grass which he describes as frumpy-looking with wide leaves and foxtail tips. USGS senior scientist and adjunct professor at the University of Arizona, Dr. Julio Betancourt, says if something isn't done soon, the ecosystem in the Sonoran Desert will change forever.
We're afraid that what we're seeing here is actually the unhinging of an American ecosystem, a unique American ecosystem. This is the only first world country where you can visit columnar cacti. If you travel around the country like I do a lot of times, people talk about, you know, when there were 16 coming to Tucson with their family and how taken they were with the landscape. I think you can also expect property values near bufflegrass stands to actually go down. And the cost of fighting fires in this area is going to rise. Most of our firemen are actually answering 911 calls for the elderly in Tucson, not fighting fires.
Aside from altering the ecosystem, Betancourt says bufflegrass also will change future fire dynamics.
When I first came to Tumamoc Hill in 1981, and sort of established my base here, this is an 860-acre preserve that's been studied for 100 years. Tumamoc Hill has basically never burned. There's never really been a fire of any extent of, let's say, more than an acre on Tumamoc Hill. Now Tumamoc Hill is actually covered, for about 40% of the reserve, covered with flammable stands of bufflegrass. Adjacent to us is A Mountain, which is pretty much in the same state, maybe a little further along.
Betancourt says one of the greatest symbols of the Sonoran Desert may begin to disappear if bufflegrass takes an even greater hold on the region.
We're going to start losing a lot of these saguaro stands to fire. So we're really concerned that the resource base, particularly the resource base that things like the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan, which is a $175 million plan to actually buy a lot of open space and set it aside for biological conservation primarily, we're concerned that what we could end up buying is something that is in transition to becoming a flammable Africanized grassland.
Eradicating bufflegrass won't be an easy or inexpensive job.
It's going to be millions of dollars, at least initially, until we can reduce the populations so that they're not growing exponentially.
Dr. Betancourt says measurements at Saguaro National Park show buffalo grass is doubling in numbers every year. He says doing nothing is not a good option.
If we don't nip it in the bud now, we're going to end up dealing with the consequences, and it's not a matter of 20, 30 years. The consequences are actually just a few years away, and every year that we fail to do something, it's going to get worse. There are a lot of people that are apt to kind of throw up their hands and say, boy, this is really so advanced that we might not be able to do anything. But I actually think millions of dollars is not that much money.
Even though buffalo grass is fully entrenched in the desert, Betancourt says he still thinks it's not too late to control it if everybody helps.
I think it's very doable. I actually don't even think it's as expensive as most people think. You just have to have the political will, the organization, and the cooperation among jurisdictions and government jurisdictions. And I think that the public has to play a major role. They need to learn how to recognize buffalo grass, take care of it in their own yards and in their own neighborhoods. And I think through volunteer efforts like Sonoran Desert Weed Whackers, which is a Pima County-supported volunteer program that works in the Tucson Mountains, I think those kind of efforts, you can actually do a heck of a lot.
You can find links on how to identify, kill, and remove buffalo grass at our website, KUAZ.org. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Robert Rappaport.
Coming up in the second half of today's show, they say it's Tucson's birthday next month. Are you going to have a good time? And Pam White talks to a researcher about what could be causing so many honeybee colonies to abruptly disappear. That's coming up next here on Arizona Spotlight. A month-long schedule of activities and public events marking the 232nd birthday of the city of Tucson are happening throughout August. And with me now to talk about some of them is Lynn Urias, director of the Celebrando El Presidio de Tucson. Thank you for coming down to the studios, Lynn.
Well, thank you for asking. This is a very exciting year for Tucson. We are officially 232 years old when you stop and think about the European inhabitation of the community. Tucson started in 13,000 BC, but we're only going to celebrate 232 years. Mm-hmm. We open on August 1st at the Presidio Corner on Washington and Church, where some of the city officials will be. Richard Elias and Vice Mayor Shirley Scott will be available, and the Donias will be there, and hope to break a piñata.
The breaking of the piñata is the official start, more or less, of
yes,
the birthday celebrations?
It's the official start, yes. And then on Saturday, August 4th, will be the fiesta in the old Presidio area, where we will take in the 11.5 acres that were originally Tucson's Presidio, which is between Washington, Church, Pennington, and Main Street. And we will take in that whole area and bring in food, native foods, foods from other cultures within the community. We will bring in demonstrators, mariachis, folkloric dancers, storytellers. There will be people who will do reenactments. We hope everybody will come in period clothing between 1775 and 1912. And there's just an awful lot going on. At 5 o'clock, we'll have a piñata for children, and we will officially have three judges that will judge the neighborhood birthday cakes, and then we'll serve the cake at 7 o'clock. But the corner at Washington and Church will specifically be for children. There will be activities and events going on there all day long. And then we have Barbara Mocking, who will do puppets and puppet making out near the county courthouse, out in the grass behind the county courthouse. So there's a lot of activity, a lot of movement, a lot of entertainment, and it should be a lot of fun for people.
Things will be going on for the whole family, not only then on the 4th, but throughout the entire month of August. An entire list of events can be found online. The website is tucsonsbirthday.org. That's tucsonsbirthday.org. What are some of the other events coming up throughout the month that you can talk about?
Well, we have a flag raising that will be presented from 8 to 10 on the 20th of August, and that will also take place in that Presidio corner. And during this time, they will raise the seven flags that have flown over Tucson. And when I say seven, we're including the Ta'an Autumn flag and the Pascua Yaqui flag with the official five, because these are Native peoples who have been here longer than the Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
We will have the Spanish flag, the Mexican flag, the Confederate flag, the Union flag, and then the Arizona flag.
So, Lynn, tell me a little bit about what's happening on August 25th at Armory Park.
Armory Park will be hosting, and Parks and Recreation will be hosting, the Fiesta de San Agustin. This event is a dedication to the Santo, of the patron saint of Tucson. The cathedral will be holding a mass that evening, and then from the cathedral, the Santo will be carried over to Armory Park, where it will be on display. There are several organizations that are involved in this, and so it should be a really fun and exciting thing for the number of activities they have going on at Armory Park.
And who will be involved in the procession that carries the Santo?
Anybody who wishes to participate, as they leave the church after the service, everybody who is at the service can join the procession and walk across the street. The Doñas of Tucson will also be a part of it. These ladies are a big part of each celebration because they represent a part of Tucson's history from the Spanish period, where women within the community who are recognized within the community are honored by the community.
Anything else you'd like to tell us about the upcoming birthday celebration, Lynn?
There is so much going on. It would be hard to pick and choose any one activity because there's several events going on every day throughout the entire month. We would love to have everybody come down August 4th to the Fiesta. The activities there were going to be going on from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., and there will be things there for everybody of every age.
There's an awful lot to choose from next month, with food, parades, music, and cultural events of all shapes and sizes happening. For a complete schedule of all of the events, you can follow the link you'll find at KUAZ.org. Scientists across North America are looking into a mysterious new disorder that is affecting the honeybee, one which can cause entire colonies to vanish virtually overnight. The phenomena is called colony collapse disorder, and it could cause serious consequences to agriculture, as honeybees pollinate over a third of all of the crops grown in the U.S. Pam White brings us the story.
Honeybees are mysteriously disappearing all over the world. Here in the United States, it's slowly becoming a catastrophe.
Some beekeepers have lost 70-80% of their colonies. Others have lost 40-50%.
We have about 70 of these small colonies.
Dr. Gloria Hoffman is a scientist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture at the Carl Hayden Bee Research Center. Most people, she says, don't realize how crucial honeybees are to our everyday lives. They pollinate crops worth in excess of $16 billion, at least a third of our agriculture.
essential components of things like cancer prevention diets, heart-healthy diets. They're the berries, fruits, vegetables.
The phenomenon is called colony collapse disorder, or CCD, and no one knows what's causing it. Bees are dying in such dramatic numbers, some refer to it as AIDS for the bee industry. It could be a virus, a fungus, genetically modified crops, even cell phones are being blamed.
The bee lab here is close to a cell phone tower, and our bees seem to find their way back to the hives without too much problem.
Experts think colony collapse disorder could have multiple causes. Last year, Dr. Hoffman says honeybees were already struggling. Little rainfall deprived them nutritionally, and warm temperatures lasting until December in parts of the Midwest and the East made the bees weak. And when it's warm, Dr. Hoffman says bees still go out to forage even if there's nothing to eat.
And bees age when they fly. That's one of the ways that they cruise towards their death is by foraging, is by flying. And so they were taking what we call empty flights in December and aging. And those are your bees that you're hoping are going to be foraging for you in the spring.
Stressed out colonies become susceptible to all sorts of illnesses. Another problem, no state in the country is completely self-sufficient with honeybee colonies, so they must be brought in.
The beekeeping industry, you would move bees once or twice a year and supplement your income with honey production. That's more or less changed, and beekeepers are now moving their colonies numerous times a year. And, you know, honeybee colonies weren't meant to do that.
And while researchers are exploring all sorts of possibilities for CCD, Dr. Hoffman says it could be something that hasn't been discovered yet.
Recently, we've been importing packages of bees from Australia to meet the pollination needs, primarily of almond growers in California. And we know what the symptomologies look like for bee diseases, but it's not what you know that hurts you. It's the things that you don't know. And until they become manifest, you don't even begin to look for them.
Not only are bees disappearing, scientists don't understand why the hives they left behind remain untouched.
That was very unusual, yes. And those hives have been sampled, and analysis is being done on the comb and the pollen and the honey that's still in those colonies. But it's like looking for a needle in a haystack when you do studies like that to try and find exactly what it could be.
Nationally, the estimate is that 25% of the 2.4 million honeybee colonies are affected by this disorder. And if beekeepers can't revive their colonies in the next year or two, and this phenomenon continues, Dr. Hoffman says the consequences will be far more widespread than most people think.
Our ecosystems are really a web of life, and you pull out one piece of it and it reverberates throughout, and pulling out the bees is a huge piece and have repercussions both on the animals,
the honeybee,
the plants, the soil, microbes in the soil, and ultimately to us, because you know we're part of this ecosystem whether we realize it or not.
For KUAT, I'm Pam White.
The research into what's causing CCD and how to treat it is an ongoing process. We've got links to more information posted online at KUAZ.org. Water is a complex subject here in Arizona, and experts can agree that giving proper water education to kids will be a major component in overcoming the water issues of the future. Over a dozen contributors have collaborated on a book to do just that. It's called Arizona Conserve Water. Next, Julie Burock will talk by phone with Carrie Schwartz in Phoenix, who is the book's co-author and the director of Arizona Project WET.
First, before we talk about the book, let's talk about our current water situation here in Arizona. What should we be doing to protect our water supply?
Yeah, you know, we're in a long-term drought, and we live in an arid place, and so we really need to be a society that thinks about water conservation all the time, that has water conservation as part of our our habit of mind and part of it, what we do every day.
And what should we do? What are some of the things that we should be doing around our own home to save water?
Well, we use most of our water at our homes outside. And so, you know, they say that in all communities in Arizona, if we just saved half the water that, falls on our own home and in our yards and use that for, you know, desert landscaping that's beautiful, desert landscaping, native landscaping that blooms and is beautiful, then, you know, we could save half the water use that we use in our homes just by using our rainfall better.
The book is called Arizona Conserve Water. What was your goal in writing it?
You know, back to, 2 years ago, at a town hall, Governor Napolitano called for a culture of conservation, and she talked about Arizona being a leader in water conservation. And the Arizona Project WET program and Arizona Department of Water Resources and Bureau of Reclamation picked up on that, and they said, well, you know, let's do this. Let's expand our current education program to have an educator's guide that's specific to Arizona and that really is promoting water conservation, you know, more so than any other educator's guide that's out there. And so we took on that project about 2 years ago.
And this is really directed towards teachers in the classroom who can teach their students about water conservation.
It is. It was written for K-12 teachers, and we involve teachers. The way the books, these books are put together is resource people and teachers are all together in the same room, so we have many brains working on these lessons. And so it's got the best content, and it's got the best teaching methods. In other words, we're not just lecturing. We're using kinesthetic learning and visual learning and getting all of the teaching methods in there so that we make sure that we reach all learners.
Because that really is the solution to the problem, is teaching the younger generation about this water crisis and how we can protect our water supply and make sure it's there for years to come.
You know, that's right. I mean, you know, if we get it in our heads that this is what we do, if it becomes the habit of mind and just what we do every day, then water conservation will be, you know, will happen, and we'll be able to have more water for the communities that, you know, are all connected. Our water supplies are all connected, and we need to think of it that way.
How many teachers are currently using the water guide?
Well, actually, we just got it published, so I actually just did the first two trainings on this guide last week and yesterday, and I apologize for my voice. I think I talked my voice right out yesterday, and so we actually haven't had a teacher use it in the classroom. That'll start this coming school year.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
The book is called Arizona Conserve Water, and for more information, you can visit the website at KUAZ.org. That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. As always, thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on today's program, including our theme, was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of our past shows, as well as podcasting of Arizona Spotlight, are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.